The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada, Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Monday morning. I hope you're doing well out there. Cleveland Browns took a tough loss yesterday, and I'm being taunted by Mark Davis and Mike Gallagher, other various scruffy characters of the radio world. They're just jealous. They're just jealous because the Browns were down two cornerbacks, both starting tackles, both starting cornerbacks, and, of course, Jarvis Juice Landry. And they still came up 6 points short, and they almost won it at SoFi playing away. So they're 3-2. They've lost to the Chiefs, and they've lost to the Chargers. Lose early, win late. That's the Browns' way when they're on their march to the Super Bowl. So that doesn't upset me. That doesn't upset me at all. I do want to begin the show by telling you I'm going to be in Atlanta on this Wednesday night. And I'm really looking forward to it because I'm looking at the brand new Financial Times story this morning. United Kingdom government bonds fall after inflation comments from rate setters. The Bank of England is now concerned that inflation has gotten out of control in United Kingdom. Now, when we set up the Biden inflation show with Brian Westbury and Alfredo Ortiz for Wednesday night in Atlanta, we did so 5 months ago, knowing that inflation might be at 3 or 4%, thinking it might start to rise next year. It's already upon us, and it's raging. And so it's really the Biden stagflation, given the job reports on Friday after I went off the air. The very disappointing job report came out. The economy is back to the 70s, and Brian Westbury, Alfredo Ortiz, and I are going to talk about it, but we're also going to be joined by Herschel Walker. So you got to come out and meet Herschel. Tickets are available to am920theanswer.com, am920theanswer.com. We got 2 days left. There are only a few tickets left. Go over there and get them. Don't be mad at me, but I'll see you on Wednesday night in Atlanta. Ed Morrissey is going to be in for me on Thursday and Friday as I have to wing off to California. But do not miss me in Atlanta on Wednesday night. Now, the most important thing is that you need to hear Joe Biden take questions after the jobs report came out on Friday.
Today, we received more evidence of the progress we're making. And I know we can make a lot more in the days ahead. I want to thank you, and God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you very much.
Oh, what do you know? He didn't take any questions. Joe Biden doesn't take any questions. What a surprise. Luckily, Terry McAuliffe did, so I've got lots of material. Gled Youngkin is running for governor of Virginia against Retread Terry, the most arrogant individual in American politics, I think. So Terry McAuliffe is flailing down in the polls, had the worst week possible, botching a debate and a roundtable by first telling parents they shouldn't be involved in their kids' school boards, and then second, to an African-American journalist telling her that her questions about critical race theory, she asked three times, were dog whistles. So he tried to kiss and make up with Dana Bash on with the liberals in California, because he's losing liberals in Virginia. He's losing votes to Princess Blanding, who's a third-party progressive African-American woman who is running and siphoning off lots of votes. There's no enthusiasm for Terry McAuliffe, who's frankly, he's out of gas. He's just going through the motions. Cut number 15, Terry McAuliffe tries yet again to talk about schools and education in Virginia.
I really hate to see what Glenn Youngkin is trying to do to Virginia, what Donald Trump did our country. I really hate to see the division, the hatred. We're putting these children in this horrible position. Let's just be clear. We don't teach critical race theory. This is a made up, this is a Trump, Betsy DeVos, Glenn Youngkin plan to divide people. And it really bothers me.
You see, Dana asked him, what about critical race theory? And once again, he didn't answer. It continues. Cut number 16.
I guess going back to 2000, do you think Republicans stole that election?
In 2000?
Uh-huh.
I wish the United States Supreme Court had let them finish counting the votes.
Yes, he still thinks it was stolen. See, Glenn Youngkin can't go anywhere given that he's running against parents and he's running against the 2000 election, and he's trying to make Trump into Glenn Youngkin and Glenn Youngkin into Trump, which isn't flying. And so Dan Abash says this, cut number 17.
Other issue, you mentioned Donald Trump. I'm glad I have two cups here so I can keep drinking when you mentioned Donald Trump's name. But
yeah, see, that was her trick. She had two cups of water and she took a drink every time Terry McAuliffe mentioned Donald Trump's name. And it was funny because that's the whole campaign. He's getting crushed. He's getting crushed. I think it's going to be one of those, how did we get this so wrong elections? Because Democrats don't like him. African-American progressives are voting for Princess Bland. And Glenn Youngkin is a perfect candidate from Central Casting who's done a terrific job as a new face with a great, great appeal on the stump. So I'm pretty happy about that. Here are the headlines. Youth voter turnout in Virginia soared with Trump in office. Well, let's stay that way. This is called Throw Terry a Lifeline. Maybe the kids will help him. No, they're not going to vote for him. Then suddenly, two papers, our biggest two papers, the Post, the Wall Street Journal, the three biggest are the Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Times. Two of them have stories. Here's the Wall Street Journal. Biggest U.S. retailers charter private cargo ships to sail around port delays because you can't get your goods to land. And then the New York Times. It's not sustainable what America's port crisis looks like up close. It looks like I've run by it, and perhaps this coming Saturday I'll be back in Huntington Beach to see how bad the oil spill is. Lines and lines and lines of ships out to sea waiting to land the goods. Southwest Airlines, if you're flying on Southwest today, make sure you call ahead. They've had to cancel 800 flights on Saturday and more than 1,000 flights on Sunday. Hopefully they're getting back to normal. They blamed air traffic control and disruptive weather, but it's not really clear why only Southwest Airlines got the deal. Millions of kids' coronavirus shots are ready to go. Initial doses to be shared on a population basis. Expect the okay from the FDA whenever they get around to it. And yeah, don't worry about it because, you know, what? It's not a crisis. We'll look at it in 3 weeks, they told us on Friday. The kids are going to be safer when they get the vaccine. There is a new story from the Israeli press this morning about the fairly rare, but nevertheless risk you don't want to run, a post-childhood COVID disease. There are about 20 jump in hospitalization of kids with post-COVID syndrome that killed a teen. There are only 25 cases of this in the world, but why run the risk at all? Your children aren't going to get sick from the vaccine. They're not going to get very sick from COVID either. But some 25 kids around the world have died from PIMS, P-I-M-S. 35 children have been hospitalized with the syndrome in Israel, including a boy aged 6 and a 6-month-old baby. It comes after they get COVID. So when the childhood vaccination is available, if you get it, you'll reduce the already small risk of PIMS. Hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops have not yet complied with the virus mandate. Well, I'll bet you that's going to be a number that doesn't shrink very much more. I don't think dishonorable discharge is going to be the appropriate remedy, but discharge will be. It's an all-volunteer army. When they signed up, vaccines weren't mandated. You could figure out what was on the way. Seems to me to be an excellent opportunity for honorable discharges for people who don't want to take it. I saw a bond. I'm not going to give you any spoilers. Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I saw a bond. I'll just tell you what the Wall Street Journal says. Latest James Bond film falls behind predecessors as COVID-19 concerns linger. That's not the only concern. U.S. Navy engineer and spouse charged in an attempt to sell nuclear submarine secrets. These were civilians who worked for the Navy. They were not. You know, they make it odd. The headline, Navy nuclear engineer and his wife charged with trying to share submarine secrets with a foreign country. Look, you dummies, if you try and do that, we're going to find you. The FBI is pretty good at that. From the Wall Street Journal, severe drought adds to Afghanistan's woes, endangering millions as economy collapses. That's remarkable. By the way, another flight got out over the weekend, another 20 American citizens, another 80 LPRs by virtue of a third-party group got out over the weekend. They're lying to us about how many people are there, but now we're finding out a desperate drought is going to hit Afghanistan. And the Taliban, of course, will be exactly the water engineers you think they are when it comes time to arranging water relief. Finally, a very long story in the Washington Post on Wisconsin. It's not about the Wisconsin football team. By the way, it's Victory Monday for the Ohio State Buckeyes. The Browns may have gone down at SoFi last night, but the Buckeyes won 66-20 or something like that. Oddly enough, because of the SEC Mafia, the Alabama team only fell to 5 after losing to number 12 or 13 Texas A&M. Ohio State fell to number 8 after losing to number 5 Oregon. It just doesn't make any sense except for the SEC nonsense. Don't go anywhere, America, especially not to the Alabama booster film breakdown. Nick will be in bad shape. But stay right here. The voice of reason is back. Hugh Hewitt is on the air, the Ted Lasso of talk radio. Stay tuned. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, Inside the Beltway. Over the course of my life, I've attended dozens and dozens of school board meetings for a variety of reasons. I had a couple of buddies who were on school boards that were under fire. I have been on an advisory council to a school board. I was on a grant-making institution that often made grants to school boards. And they're often lively. They've never, ever been the attention of anyone like Selena Zito. They are now. Selena Zito, of course, columnist for the Washington Examiner and the New York Post, has got the Pittsburgh school board in her eye and Dr. Paul Carson showing up at it. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning. How are you today?
Always great. I think it's wonderful you are writing about school boards. Tell us what the column is and why it was on your mind.
Well, you know, last week there was some scuttlebutt about the Department of Justice being pressured by, and now, I'm going to forget the acronym, the alphabet soup school boards, that people that attend them were getting out of hand, and so that the DOJ should be, and they're trying to walk this back now and say they didn't want this. However, they did say it that they wanted people that attended school boards that, you know, were too lively, got out of hand, and were threatening, would be deemed domestic terrorists and treated as such. And this kind of backfired.
Oh, big time, because all of a sudden people see the Attorney General of the United States saying that Ma and Pa Kettle are upset with critical race theory or domestic terrorists because they're upset at the local school board.
Yeah, you know, I mean, school board meetings, I have gone with my mother as a teenager. I have gone as a parent. I've had to cover them. I've told young reporters it's the first place you want to learn about the American, you know, sort of conversation about what's important in their lives is to cover a school board because they were the most intense. But you know, you're talking about your child and or traditionally at a school board meeting, it's either about, you know, something that impacts your child, which by the way, schools have your child more than you do after a certain age, and or the taxes. And how, you know, is this going to impact where I live? And also school districts are places that draw people to live in the community and or cause people to flee a community if they're not doing well. So schools are very, these school board meetings are incredibly important.
And they can be heated, by the way. I have been at so many heated school board members, and sometimes it's because the cheerleaders aren't getting enough of the budget. Other times it's because the theater hasn't been finished. Another time it's because a teacher has been moved or a principal fired. More often than not, it's because a mill has been, you know, a levy has been put on the local ballot trying to get 2/3. I led one of those once. School boards are feisty. They have never not been feisty.
They have always been feisty. And that's a good thing. These are very important entities in our lives, and school boards have been around since the 17th century. I mean, they have been around. They began in Massachusetts, and they've been part of our conversation and part of making our communities better for as long, but since before we even exist as a nation.
So why did Dr. Carson finally go down to the Pittsburgh school board? What motivated him to finally? He had never gone to a school board meeting before.
Right. Well, there are numerous things that are going wrong. By the way, he's from Cleveland. So,
well, good. He had good sense.
I think he wore a brown shirt to one.
We got hosed last night. Joe Thomas says we got hosed. We got hosed. But I digress.
So, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are deeply concerned about, you know, what happens to you in today's culture. You know, and so this thing with the DOJ even made it worse because, you know, you worry about, and Carson was worried about his reputation. He was worried about how it's going to be used against him. There was nothing inflammatory that he wanted to say. We've had so many problems here in Western Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, with our school, the city of Pittsburgh school district, from it being closed for over a year, no school buses for the children. We've had a problem with the superintendent who was eventually forced to resign. So, you know, there have been a number of problems with the city, Pittsburgh City Schools. Again, this is normal, but, you know, at first he was very hesitant because he was unsure of, you know, how, you know, is this going to be used as a weapon? Is someone going to sort of, you know, video me if I have something to say
and
use against him?
And cancel.
Right. Right.
Well, I'm glad he went anyway. It's amazing to me that school boards across the United States have been shuttered for a year and now they don't have enough buses. What do you think they were planning for a year? Did they not plan to reopen ever? I'm astonished.
It is stunning, the incompetence.
Incompetence. It's institutionalized incompetence at school districts across America. That's why Glenn Youngkin's going to be the next governor of Virginia. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you, Selena Zito. Everything about Selena is at selenazito.com. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. Reminding everyone in Atlanta, I will be in Atlanta on Wednesday night with Herschel Walker at the Atlanta History Center. I'll also be joined by Brian Westbury, who is my regular guest, the economist from Chicago, who you frequently see on CNBC, talking about the Biden stagflation that is upon us. What a horrible jobs number. On Friday, after my show was off the air, out came the jobs number. Maybe the worst job number. I'll play that for you in just a second. I'm waiting for Jake Sherman of Punchbowl News. Maybe Jake has been interrupted by a breaking news story. I never know. He's usually as reliable as a clock. And I've already read, you know what I'll bet this is? I'll bet that they wrote the Punchbowl News. It's a holiday, of course, for the federal government. And I'll bet you they wrote this last night. Maybe not. Maybe that's Jake right now. I was going to about to slander Jake Sherman. Jake, it's you. I was about to slander you and say, I'll bet you they wrote Punchbowl News last night and took the day off because the feds were off. Welcome back, buddy.
No, we are not off. My phone was on silent. I apologize to you.
Not a problem. Jake Sherman of Punchbowl News. Get your Punchbowl News at punchbowlnews.com. Jake, last hour I played Chuck Schumer's speech. You wrote your assessment of the Biden legislative agenda. Did you take into account the impact of the Schumer speech, which Barrasso told Maria Bartiromo yesterday, has deeply soured the Republican caucus? I mean, to the point they don't want to talk to the guy.
Yeah, listen, I actually don't. I mean, they didn't talk much to him anyway, so I don't find that to be a big. I don't find it to be dispositive. I've been through a lot of cycles where speeches were supposed to ruin relationships. The fact is, the reality is, there's not much cooperation that we anticipate anyway. I think the conventional wisdom is wrong on the Democratic side. I think that because McConnell blinked in this last debt limit fight, it makes it less likely to blink again. And I think that. I don't think the speech is what did it. It's not like we were in a golden era for cooperation.
What did you make of Joe Manchin's face in his hands and then leaving?
Well, we reported at the time that he used an expletive and said it was,
I read that.
Or so. Yes. Yeah. I can't remember exactly what it was. I'm the cynic here, as you know, Hugh. I think that being against Schumer is beneficial for Joe Manchin. But I do think Joe Manchin owns Chuck Schumer in a way, in the sense that he can't get anything done. Schumer can't without Joe Manchin. So, what Manchin said in many respects was right, that if you want to have more progressive agenda and you don't want to have to worry about Joe Manchin, you should elect more progressives to the Senate, you know? And I think that's the reality of it.
Now, can I explain to you my theory of what happened last week? I think Mitch McConnell won, even though people think he lost. I think he intended people to think he lost so that he could win in December. He could not allow the debt crisis right now. So he waited and waited and waited, extended it till December, and he will allow it in December. He couldn't allow it now because it might have assisted the reconciliation and going to a higher number. Now the Democrats have to work out their reconciliation, and if they do, they're going to have passed trillions of dollars in spending, and they're going to have to borrow for it through reconciliation to get it. Your take, Jake Sherman.
I don't think that, I think that he... I don't think that he won or lost. I think this was kind of a stupid fight it was a stupid deal that really screws over everyone involved. I mean, I agree with you. He couldn't have he could not afford to have a default. And he did I would say he won because Schumer's main argument against reconciliation and lifting the debt ceiling of reconciliation was that he didn't have time. That was Schumer's main argument.
Yep.
Now, he can't make that argument. I hear that. I do hear that. There's a lot of anger in the Republican conference, though. I mean, we can't underestimate that. But on what McConnell did, there's no movement to get rid of him. That silliness that is coming from wherever Trump. I don't know getting that from.
Oh, you mean getting rid of McConnell? Not a chance.
Yeah,
not a chance. The best legislative leader the Republicans have had in my lifetime. That includes Bob Dole, for whom I have enormous respect.
Yes. So, listen, win, loss, I don't think anyone really won or anyone really lost here. I mean, it's not like McConnell gave something up. You know, I mean, he didn't give anything up here.
And they did not get their act together. I was afraid the one thing he might have forced was a deal on the reconciliation top line so that the Democrats could get their act together and pass a reconciliation amendment. Now they're just going to fight among themselves. And they're not going to. We're going to see a replay of this in December, Jake. Right? We're going to see the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that we're going to see. I mean, listen. There's a lot of, and we, as you noted this morning. I mean, it's not as if they're close. I mean, there's just a lot between now and then when it comes to reconciliation and everything like that. There's just a lot of. There's a lot that needs to get done, and then there's government funding. So there's just, yes, we are entering a frenzied period. I don't think McConnell could have forced a deal on a top-line number. I just don't think that would have been possible.
Now, at the beginning of the year, Joe Biden's full agenda was a $9 trillion spending package, of which he's already banked two. Then he wanted two more in infrastructure and five in Build Back Better. He's down to a maximum total of 4.5. So he's going to get maybe half of his agenda. In Punchbowl News today, this really bothers me. They're fixated on FDR. They don't seem, I took FDR history from Frank Friedel. I actually know a little bit about FDR. This has got nothing to do with FDR. FDR has programs like Civilian Conservation Corps, like the Public Works Progress Administration, like the National Artist Act. Like, there are all sorts of different things that he did. They've done nothing like that. And FDR didn't even work. And if he'd ended after two terms, he would have been a failure because the recession came back in 38. It was World War II that made FDR a genius. What does Biden not understand about FDR?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think they're trying to talk about just big programs and big priorities and getting big things done. I hear you on the specifics. But I mean, listen, if they are, I would say just from a top level point of view, if they are able to get all of this done, that is impressive at a 50-50 Senate. I mean, what will it do to them politically? I don't know the answer to that. And only time will tell as the clock, how the clock ticks, I guess you could say. But I hear you on that. I don't think they're talking about necessarily the specifics. I think it's shorthand for just getting big things done.
All they are doing is spending money. FDR didn't spend enough, and we stayed in a depression, and then they had a recession in 38 after the recovery began. Here we're going to get stagflation, and those job numbers, Jake, on Friday, wow. What did you hear about those on the Hill? Because that was a bucket of cold water in everybody's face.
Yeah, listen, it was the Democrats say they need to get the agenda done, which is an interesting take and not a take that I think you would share with them.
No.
But it is it has people nervous, right? I mean, we're seeing a lot of the same signals that we saw of back in 2010 and 2009. I'm looking at the redistricting stuff and the political, the Dave Wassermans and all those folks who are really looking at the maps. And I mean, listen, you see a climate brewing that Republicans could win 15 to 20 seats. I mean, that's what I think a lot of people think right now. We don't know. We're a long way away. And job numbers like this, although listen, there's some details. There's more that than meets the eye. But I mean, job numbers like this is not what you want to see if you're a Democrat.
I think Democrats would take a 15 loss seat right now. I think they would take a loss of 15 and hope to get back. I'm more interested in Virginia. Let's finish there. Terry McAuliffe had a terrible week at the debate, at the roundtable with Dana Bash yesterday. I think Glenn Youngkin has got the wind at his back. What do you think?
Well, I mean, he definitely has the wind at his back in the sense that Terry McAuliffe keeps talking about how Congress has not passed a reconciliation bill, an infrastructure bill, and he's bashing Congress. I mean, that's easy thing to bash. But yeah, listen, I think if Republicans win in Virginia, people are going to see that as another signal when it comes to the 2022 electoral prospects.
What's your over-under on Princess Blanding, the third-party progressive African-American candidate in Virginia? What percent?
No, I have no idea. I really have no idea. I'm going to stick to Congress.
I think it's 3%, and I think that spells doom for Terry McAuliffe. Jake Sherman, always a pleasure. Punchbowl News, very interesting this morning, as it is every morning, America. Go over to punchbowlnews.com and subscribe. I almost slandered Jake. I did not slander Jake, though. He was indeed. Jake Awake is always a deal on Monday morning. I thought maybe because the federal government is off today that maybe Jake was kind of mailing it in last night. But no, live here inside the Beltway, Jake Sherman, the Punch Bowl News. I'll be right back. 1-800-520-1234. This book, Risk, by General Stanley McChrystal, will be the subject next hour. Don't forget, Alliance Defending Freedom. There's a banner over at the top of HughHewitt.com. Please go and be as generous as you can be. We need ADF in the trenches. We need ADF in the courtrooms. We need ADF at the Supreme Court, and we need them this year more than ever. Contribute what you can at HughHewitt.com. The banner will come up at the very top, then come right back. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Monday morning, joined by Secretary Elaine Chao, formerly Secretary of Transportation, Secretary of Labor, also CEO of the United Way, former director of the Peace Corps. Basically, she's done everything, including going out with other fellow former cabinet members to honor the late George Shultz. That was quite a gathering of national security superstars. Secretary Chao, welcome. Good morning. Tell us about it.
Oh, good morning. It was actually very inspiring. We had all the previous living Secretary of State in attendance, and each gave a wonderful, moving, touching eulogy about the effects and impact that Secretary Shultz had on the United States in keeping us safe and taking a long-term point of view. Current Secretary of Transportation Anthony Blinken was there as well. I got to know Secretary Shultz because I have relatives living out in California. So I would go out there in, you know, during the Christmas break. And every time he heard that I was there, he would invite me to lunch. And it was invariably at his house in on the Stanford campus. And he was thinking about some big issue that was impacting our country. He prodded policymakers to think beyond the usual, to think about the future. And I think all will say that he was very instrumental in kind of keeping focus on the big issues. Interestingly enough, I heard from Karen Tumulty, who wrote a recent biography called The Triumph of Nancy Reagan. And in that book, Karen Tumulty mentions that Nancy Reagan engineered a private upstairs in the residence dinner with Secretary Shultz and his wife, because then President Ronald Reagan was concerned about the Cold War, was interested in knowing some of his opposing with some of the other leaders who he would not have had a chance to speak with. And that became the beginning of a series of dialogue and discussions about negotiations at Reykjavik.
George Shultz is the most amazing fellow. 10 years ago, when he was only in his 90s, he dedicated the law school, which I speak, the Fowler School of Law, where I teach at Chapman in Orange County. And he gave a stand-up address without notes that went for about an hour, and everyone was stunned. But every time I've met him, he's always just introduced himself as George Shultz, United States Marine. I like that about him as well. But what a great American. What a great gathering of people. I'm glad you were there to represent the McConnell-Chow family. Yeah. Secretary Chow, I want to talk to you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Henry Kissinger was there, and Kanji Rice, and Jim Baker, and General Mattis, Senator Nunn. It was really quite a promenade of prominent Americans who have played such important roles in our country.
People don't know that George Shultz is actually also responsible in large part for the desegregation of Southern schools, which happened under Richard Nixon, also not very well known. Shultz is the man. We have him on tape at the Nixon Library getting that done. George Shultz, before OMB, before everything else, he was charged with and successfully executed the strategy of desegregating Southern schools. Secretary Chow, I'm glad you were available today because there are two headlines. One from the Wall Street Journal, biggest U.S. retailers charter private cargo ships to sail around port delays. Then in the New York Times, it's not sustainable. What America's port crisis looks like up close. There aren't enough workers. There aren't enough ships. You've been the Secretary of Labor and the Secretary of Transportation. What do we do?
Well, I think this is a very dire situation. You know, when COVID initially hit our shores early in 2020, I was in Secretary of Transportation, and we quickly focused on keeping the transportation supply chains open, you know, in our country, so that essential medical supplies, groceries, and other essentials were available. And that effort actually required some pretty strong measures. Number one, we decided to ease some restrictions on truckers so that they can keep goods moving. We made sure that the national airspace kept airplanes flying because, you know, even though at one point planes were nearly empty of passengers, commercial airliners also routinely transport a lot of goods, especially medical supplies. You know, remember those early days of the initial lockdowns? We had hoarding of toilet paper, sanitizer wipes, shortage of masks. Stores were putting limits on how much customers can buy of one item. And more than 70% of domestic freight moves via trucks. But today's supply chain problems extend all the way from foreign ports, where worker shortages and COVID lockdowns have slowed the loading of cargo ships from where they started to U.S. ports, primarily the West Coast ports, where, as you've just mentioned, the other day there were over 60 tankers, freighters, container ships, with tens of thousands of storage containers offshore waiting for an opportunity to unload.
Oh, and for Saturday mornings, for as long as I've been on the radio, I have trundled along Huntington Beach from Newport Beach 60th Street to the pier. I have never seen lines of cargo ships like now. Now, they also have an oil spill to deal with, but And it may be related to those tankers maybe putting an anchor down on one of the pipelines. We don't know for sure yet. But the line of ships, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing. And the shipping industry, the trucking industry, ports, railroads, they're all experiencing worker shortages. Shipping across the Pacific Ocean is taking twice as long now as COVID, before COVID, about 80 days. And the cost of moving these storage containers have tripled or more. And as you mentioned, now it's gotten so bad that some big retailers are renting entire cargo ships. And that's leaving smaller businesses who can't afford to rent entire cargo ships at a further competitive disadvantage.
So I'm in favor of the infrastructure bill because it does have a few billion dollars for ports, which are badly needed. But what do you think ought to be done regulatory or legally to help assist in the unclogging of what is basically a broken supply chain and a labor shortage?
I think we have to have the government stop competing with the private sector in terms of compensating workers. A shortage of labor is causing a shortage of warehouse spaces even. I mean, there are not enough workers who are willing, able to work at just moving items and moving things in warehouse spaces. Roughly 98% of warehouses in Southern California's Inland Empire region are full. And the entire Western United States has a mere 3.6% vacancy rate.
Wow.
Overall container volumes at the Port of Los Angeles have increased 30% this year. Meanwhile, trucking capacity has only increased 8%, and they need about 25% more, warehouse spaces. So this is adding up that a supply chain with a lot of moving parts, as you mentioned, is not moving as quickly as we need it to.
So the number one,
it's going to have an impact on Christmas too.
Oh, we're not canceling Christmas. We're not going Dr. Fauci here. But I know that the Journal says the reason these retailers have chartered entire ships is that they do not want to have empty shelves at Christmas. The number one problem then is unemployment compensation extended beyond the period of necessity. Is that it?
Well, 28 states have decided to pull back. But basically, the whole situation with workers overall, the labor participation rate is very low. When I was Secretary of Labor, the average labor participation rate was about 66.4% from 2001 to 2009. And the at high point, labor participation rate was about 67.7%. Now the labor participation rate is 61.6%.
Wow.
It even dropped 0.1% from the last month. So basically what this, and pre-COVID, the labor participation rate was already very low at 63.3%. So with a workforce of 157 million workers, we're seeing about 4.8 million workers who have just left the workforce and they're not coming back. Now, this is a very serious problem because if we do not have enough workers to fuel the recovery, that will slow the economy, obviously, but it will also put inflationary pressures on everything. And so we're seeing, for example, restaurants that can't open the hours that they need to or fill up their restaurant with the usual number of tables because they don't have workers. We're seeing that also in trucking. We're seeing that in railroads and in construction. Construction has improved somewhat. Last month, construction actually lost 3,000 jobs. So this month's, last month's job report, which came out last Friday, was very weak.
Oh, it was terrible. It was a horrible jobs report. I'm curious what you think about the eviction moratorium extensions. This is the equivalent to unemployment compensation bumps, but if you remove or put on a moratorium the ability to evict someone for non-payment of rent, it reduces the pressure on people to work. I mean, it's even economically rational in some cases not to work. I think all of these incentives have to be removed to stay home.
Well, first of all, we want to make sure, of course, that those who are vulnerable should be taken care of. But the government should not be competing with the private sector when it comes to compensation, whether it's in the form of monetary benefits, debt forgiveness, rent relief, or other subsidies. If it does, the labor shortage that we see today could become the norm for tomorrow. And that would be devastating for the quality of life that Americans have come to expect, as well as for our standing in the world and ability to compete globally.
Last question, Secretary. The Savannah port story that I read yesterday about how the port of Savannah is booming, they're all booming in the United States. Isn't this also an opportunity for port operators to expand and rebuild, though?
This is an excellent opportunity. It's very busy, but actually, you know, expansion should be occurring all the time. And some airports, to switch to airports rather than ports, you know, during the COVID, a lot of airports took that downtime to expand and to rehabilitate and repair. And they were aided, of course, by some of the CARES dollars that was passed in March 27th, 2020, the previous year. But the overall situation is one of a labor market slowly recovering from the pandemic, struggling to recover, but faced with significant worker shortages, especially when there are 11 million unfilled jobs. Now, next week, this week, we're going to be seeing the new JOLTS study. It's called the BLS. It's a monthly BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. This is a dynamic measurement as to how many jobs are available within the economy. And we currently have about 11 million jobs that are vacant, so that are seeking workers. And GDP in the second quarter grew at a revised rate of 6.7%. Inflation's running at 5.2% on an annual basis. So what it says the workers are suffering as well because their wages are not increasing as rapidly.
So we will look for the JOLTS report. Elaine Chao, former Secretary of Labor and Transportation, thank you. The update is useful, and I'm very glad to have the first-person report on Secretary Schultz Memorial as well. Thank you, Madam Secretary. She's always a wealth of information. Of course, when you've done as many jobs as Elaine Chao has, you're always going to know what's going on out there. I remind everyone, Alliance Defending Freedom, Alliance Defending Freedom. Tom Tratip can't get me any audio actuals today because he's wandering around in a bathrobe because the Alabama Crimson Tide were beat, and he's a little bit stunned. But just trust me, the Alliance Defending Freedom needs your help. I need you to help them via HughHewitt.com. Their banner will come up at top. Don't forget as well, ReliefFactor.com. Next hour, I'm talking to Stanley McChrystal, who remains one of the great runners, even after some spine surgery he talks about in the book Risk. He runs and runs and runs and runs. He's older than I am. And why does he do so? He just stays in great shape. And if you want to stay in great shape, do ReliefFactor.com. 1995 gets you started. 1995 gives you Icarian, Curcumin, Resveratrol, Omega every day in an easy-to-open, easy-to-swallow set of four natural supplements. The only ones I take. The only thing I take is ReliefFactor.com. And doctor's pills, yes. But I mean, I'm not a supplement guy. I never take any supplements except ReliefFactor.com. Proven by science to help your body fight off inflammation, the minor aches and pains of aging and exercise. Coming right back, America. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hey, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Monday morning. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, General Stanley McChrystal joins me, retired United States Army, to talk about his new book on risk. But I begin this hour with a former law student. In fact, when anyone ever mentions Henry II's turbulent priest comment, I always think of Timothy Sandifer, top left corner of the law school classroom. I've been teaching for 25 years, and if anyone says meddlesome priest or turbulent priest, I think of Timothy Sandifer. I'd be talking about the train limit law of 1912 and how it applied to trains of 14 freight or 70 passengers length. And Sandifer would say, "You've got that backwards, Professor. It's 14 passengers and 70, and yeah, that's what he did. And I am hoping that this new Supreme Court case he is into gets to the Supreme Court, that they grant cert, and he gets to argue it, because I'm going to go over and see him correct the Chief Justice. That's what I'm looking forward to, Tim Sandifer. Good morning.
Good morning. Actually, you remind me of the time that I attended a presentation by Justice Scalia about a year before his death, where he made the mistake of saying that the slaughterhouse cases of 1873 was correctly decided. I shouted from the audience that was incorrect, and a friend of mine came up to me afterwards and said, "Well, you finally got to argue a case in front of Justice Scalia."
Well, you know, you had practice in my classroom. You really are. It's really quite something to have a brilliant mind always correcting you on many things, factual and legal. Tim, but you were passionate about the Brett Keene case, and I know why. And I can't even actually believe that the Indian Child Welfare Act exists. I don't profess to understand why it exists, why it isn't prima facie unconstitutional, but why don't you explain to me, has it got something to do with the sovereign constitutional status of the tribes?
Well, that's the excuse that's often given. So this is a law that was passed in 1978 that restricts the ability of non-Native American adults to adopt children of Native American ancestry, and that restricts the ability of states to protect these children against abuse and neglect. Now, we're not talking about kids who live on reservation. This law does not apply on reservation. We're talking about children who are genetically eligible. That is, their ancestry entitles them to membership in an Indian tribe. So these are not necessarily children who are actually members. It's just kids who could become members of tribes. If these kids are being abused or neglected, the state government cannot come in and rescue them from abuse and neglect unless the state officials prove a higher standard of evidence than is the requirement for kids of other races. Now, that sounds complicated, but what it boils down to is this. If a black child or a white child or an Asian child is being abused or neglected by their parents, the state could come in and take that child into foster care if it has evidence of that abuse or neglect. If it's a child of Native American ancestry, then the state has to have more evidence of abuse. And if we're talking, in some cases, you know, a parent is so abusive that the state has to terminate the rights of that parent in order to protect that child, which is a severe step, right? But if we're talking about kids of other ancestries, Asian kids, Hispanic kids, the standard of evidence that applies there is what they call clear and convincing evidence. But with Native American kids, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt with the testimony of expert witnesses that the child is in immediate danger. And what that means is it is literally easier to put a defendant on death row than it is to find an adoptive home for a child of Native American ancestry in this country.
I'm astonished by this, Tim Sandifer, for a number of reasons. Number one, I've done work on the child welfare system in America. I know it's broken, very, very badly broken from east coast to west, from north to south, in a thousand different ways. It is dysfunctional. I was unaware until you wrote about it and informed me about Brackeen that there was built into one portion of that complicated array of statutes, 50 states worth, plus the District of Columbia, and now tribal consideration, on the face of it, distinction based on race. Now, Chief Yep. Justice Roberts has said the way to end racism is to end the use of race. I can't believe this survives Supreme Court review.
Oh, I certainly am shocked that it has survived as long as it has myself. But the excuse that's typically given is, well, when you're talking about Native Americans, you're not really talking about race because tribes are like political organizations. So the distinction here isn't racial, it's really political. Well, even if you buy that theory, it doesn't apply here because we're talking about children who have no political connection to a tribe at all, who don't speak a native language, who don't practice a native religion, who have never even visited tribal land. There was a case about 5 years ago in Southern California involving Lexi, a six-year-old girl who had been living in foster care for 4 years of her life. She was her great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a full-blood Choctaw Indian, and as a result, she qualified as an Indian child under this law, even though she did not speak Choctaw, did not reside on Choctaw lands, did not practice a Native religion, and really had no idea that she was Choctaw in the eyes of the law. And as a result, ICWA deprived her of the legal protections that apply to children of other races. And she was snatched from the arms of the foster family she had lived with for 4 years of the 6 years of her life and sent to live with race-matched strangers in Oklahoma instead on the orders of the tribal government. It's a shock.
No, Tim Sandifer, I taught you better than to say ICWA. You know, I really did. I failed there as a professor when you snuck ICWA in there. You want to explain what that is again?
Yeah, ICWA stands for the Indian Child Welfare Act, and you're right. Not only should I not use technical jargon, but it gets very confusing because when you're talking about Indian law, everything sounds the same. Like, there's IGRA, the Indian Gaming Regulatory. There's lots of laws that all have a similar sounding name.
Well, you are with the Goldwater Institute. I am curious how this came into your ken. How did you... I know you were one of the great advocates of liberty and a free society in America, and the Goldwater Institute proposes that. But how did you get wrapped up in Brackeen?
Well, my predecessor at the Goldwater Institute was a guy named Clint Bullock, who's now on the Arizona Supreme Court. And this was kind of a passion project for him when he was a lawyer with the Institute. And then when I came in, I kind of took over the project from him. And this, so that was about 6 years ago. I had never even heard of the Indian Child Welfare Act at that time. And so, you know, I come in and they drop this big pile of paper on my desk and say, read this. And I was absolutely amazed that this law exists. It is probably the most unconstitutional law ever passed.
What I mean by that is it
violates so many different constitutional restrictions. You're talking about race-based discrimination. You're talking about the feds coming in and telling states how they can operate their own child welfare systems, which is a matter of state law only. The feds have no business in the child welfare business. This law even ignores technical rules about how courts obtain jurisdiction, because it says that tribal courts can decide child welfare cases of children based on the fact that their genetic ancestry falls within that tribe, even if the child has never even visited that reservation. I mean,
Let me geek out for a second and ask you, is it Section 5 of the 14th Amendment? Are they holding that up as an answer for how this survives?
No, it's not, which is really remarkable, because that would be a much stronger argument. Instead, they argue that, no, it's the Indian Commerce Clause, because I guess children are somehow subject to commerce.
Oh my gosh. So, Tim, when does this, is it up on CERT? What can people do, and how do they help the Goldwater Institute?
If you go to our blog, which is indefenseofliberty.blog, you can find out more about this case and our other. We've done about a dozen Indian Child Welfare Act cases across the country on this issue. So please check that out. And then Brackeen, the petitions were filed with the Supreme Court about a month ago now, and there's been an extension. So we're going to hear more about this toward the end of the year. I think it's almost certain that the Supreme Court will take this case, because the tribes, the federal government, the states, and the adoptive parents have all asked the court to take the case. So I think it's
Justice Gorsuch really threw a spanner into Native American law 2 years ago. And
he definitely did.
Yeah. And so where do you think he is on this?
Well, I think it's possible to persuade him. What you have to do is show that this law is actually bad for Indians. We're not talking about affirmative action here. We're talking about a law that takes away legal protections from Indian children based on their race, and show that this is not, when we're not talking about reservation land. Everybody agrees that tribal governments should decide child welfare cases on reservation land. We're talking about kids who live next door in residential neighborhoods, next door to their peers of other races, who enjoy stronger protections against abuse and neglect than they enjoy based on their genetic ancestry. I think if that point comes clear, I think Justice Gorsuch will see why this law is so unconstitutional and so wrong.
I hope that they grant cert. I hope that you get a chance to argue this, Tim Sandifer. And if you do, will you arrange for me to be in the first row so I can laugh at the justices when you interrupt them interrupting you?
Oh, no question. You'll be there, Professor.
All right. Tim Sandifer, always my, you know, all my law students, I love you all like everyone loves their children. But clearly my favorite was Sandifer, because he is the most meddlesome law student ever.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.